on this compressed sensing course, and especially on numerical methods for sparse recovery. So yesterday we have been proving this statement, and I asked everybody to remember a specific inequality, right? So the inequality was saying, okay, let's take eta equal to x minus delta ax, and we have been calling this x star, and we have been considering lambda, the support of the k largest entries of x in absolute value, and we have been showing that eta restricted to the complement of lambda c now 1 is less or equal than some constant sigma k of x in L1. That's what we proved, we have been proving last time. So, and this is was the fundamental step in order to conclude the proof there, and that was using a specific instance of the relationship between RAP and null space property. Okay, so today we start proving this a second statement, and that is related to the L2 norm. Unfortunately, if you remember, we were particularly interested to general statements of this type. And it can be shown that for x equal to L2, whatever decoder you want to use, or whatever encoder you want to use, then the number of measurements has to be a constant times the dimension. Okay? Which means that in this case, for the validity of this in L2, for all x in Rn, unfortunately, somehow there are some specific limitations getting into game. And therefore, there is a way out, which is considering the inequality written there. So, if you remember, writing this L2 less or equal than 1 over k over 2 for all x in the ball of L1 is actually implied by this particular inequality. Okay? And as we know, the best possible performances of the left-hand side are provided by the famous square root of logarithm of n over m plus 1 divided by m, and basically we are again in the framework of the limitations provided by the general statements that we have been looking for. Okay, so we are more or less this way. So now we are trying to prove this statement, and in this case, differently from the previous statement, we are asking that the RAP property hold with constant capital K equal to 3K. Okay, so now we have the RAP for 3K, so this is capital K, and delta K again less or equal than 1 minus square root of 2, no, square root of 2 minus 1 divided by square root of 2 plus 1. We are again in this framework. So, in particular, if the RAP holds with a certain constant delta for 3k, it holds clearly also for 2k. Okay? So in particular, this condition allows us to apply statements that we have been developing in the previous proof, in particular, onion. Okay? So that particular inequality has to hold. Okay, so we start trying to prove this statement. As before, x star is delta ax with delta the L1 minimization. And again, we consider eta equal to x star minus x belonging to the kernel of the matrix A. And we consider lambda now the set of the best 2k entries of the vector eta. Okay? Before, lambda, if you remember, was the best k entries of the support of the best k entries of x. So perhaps I like to call this lambda zero in order to distinguish it from the other one. Okay, so and we consider then the lambda j's for j between 1 and s, a decomposition of the index set in such a way that this is true, j between 1 and s, lambda j, where lambda j contains k entries for j between 1 and s minus 1, and lambda j is less or equal, lambda s is less or equal than k. And we assume again that the xj's, the lambda j's are associated to R of eta lambda c. What does it mean, R of a vector? That is the decreasing rearrangement in absolute value of the entries of the vector. In this case, we are considering those entries which are not in lambda zero. Okay, do you remember the construction from yesterday? So again, we have such decomposition. So if one has this particular choice, okay, so we start with this particular choice, one can prove one can show that eta restricted to lambda zero in L2, okay, is less or equal than 1 plus delta, 1 minus delta, k to the minus 1 over 2, eta lambda c, lambda 0 c in L1. So one has to follow precisely the proof that we did last time. But if you remember, last time we were starting with eta restricted to lambda 0 in L1. And then using the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, saying that here we have square root of 2k times eta lambda 0 in L2 and from there on. So now we forget this particular part. So this square root of 2k does not appear. And one follows the proof from that point on, and what gets exactly this. Okay? Are you with me? So the proof is exactly the same, except the fact that we forget completely the absolute first inequality. If you go back to the proof, you just go back a few lines before, you will find that this is the case. Okay? So that's how we get to this point. Now we have proven a few lemmas, okay? One of them was saying that from our first lemma, what we know is that basically sigma k of eta in L2, actually sigma 2k of eta in L2, is less or equal than what? Than 2k to the minus 1 over 2 times eta in L1. Okay? That was one of the very first estimates that we did at the very beginning. So we have been learning what does it mean best k-term approximation, and we have been checking how the best k-term approximation error decay with respect to k provided a certain approximation norm with respect to another norm. Do you remember that? Very good. So who is eta lambda 0 c in L2? Well, this is precisely sigma 2k of eta in L2, right? Because the lambda 0 contains the largest entries of eta, the 2k largest entries of eta. Therefore, we can use that in order to get the following 1 over 2 estimate in L1. Okay? But now, this can be written as 2k minus 1 over 2 of eta lambda in L, eta lambda 0 in L1 plus eta lambda 0 complement in L1. And we can use the null space property. To deduce that everything can be bounded by this quantity. So we have 2k to the minus 1 over 2, some constant, depending on the null space property, of eta lambda c in L1. Okay? Because the null space property tells us that the entries of eta on a certain set sufficiently small, the L1 norm of this vector can be bounded by the L1 norm of the vector restricted to the complement of that. Okay? Yeah. Right. Very well. Now, let's try to move this up. Okay. Okay, so eta lambda 0 c now 1 actually is less or equal than eta restricted to the support of x in 2k complement in L1. Why this should be the case? So lambda 0 contain the very largest entries of eta in absolute value. And we are considering the tails, which means the complement of it. Whatever other set of 2k entries we consider, this set has the potential of exchanging indexes that are related to large entries with indices related to small entries. Okay? So if the two don't coincide, one big guy is moving here, exchanging with one small guy. Are you with me? And therefore, somehow here we get the larger norm. Is it clear? Okay. Moreover, here we are considering the tails having taken away 2k entries. Okay? Therefore, this is less or equal than eta restricted to the support of x k complement. Because in this situation, we are considering the tails taking away a set of k entries. So we have much more thing on which we are counting now. Okay? But now, this set is our set lambda c. Okay? And now it comes into place our inequality onion over there. And we find that necessarily this is less or equal than C sigma kx in L1. Okay? So we found this particular relationship. So altogether, from there, we precisely get the following, that x star minus x in L2 is actually x star minus x in lambda 0. If you want, we can take here the squares plus, or we don't take the squares, we simply use the triangle inequality, lambda 0 c in L2. This is our eta, this is our eta, and as you see, we have two inequalities over there. One is saying that eta can be estimated by a constant k to the minus 1 over 2 times eta restricted to the complement of lambda 0, and that is in turn less or equal than this. And the second inequality is saying basically the same. So this is by another constant, whatever this constant is less or equal than this constant times sigma kx in L1 divided by k to the 1 over 2. And this is concluding the proof. Okay? So that's how this proof is constructed. As you see, this proof is particularly interesting because, or these proofs are particularly interesting because they are based on these rearrangements. And these rearrangements are indicating that whatever is the technique you use to solve these problems, the algorithms that you use actually are adaptive, okay? Because you have rearrangements coming into gain all over, and we will see it when we are dealing with a real algorithm to solve such problems. We will see that an appropriate algorithm has to use sorting. Okay, sorting means really using the rearrangements. So up to this point, we found that we can construct algorithms and in particular decoders called delta that are optimal in the sense that we have been looking for at the very beginning. And this is true for the L1 minimization, and probably today we'll start to see a first algorithm to solve L1 minimization in a fast way. Under the condition that the matrix we have has the null space property or some version of the null space property, okay, with a parameter k valid. We know that k cannot be larger asymptotically than a certain type of quantity depending on the dimensionalities of the matrix. So we have something like that. And so we have to wonder, how can we construct matrices with the property, with the null space property or the RIP property, with the K maximal, with K that maximally scale with this quantity. Are you with me? Okay. So that's the next task. So we understood that decoder are possible with this optimality that we were looking for, but now we have to learn whether matrices that allow this decoder to exist. Okay? So we have been learning that the null space property can be checked via, provided that we can check the restricted isometry property. They are related. Okay? So the issue is, can we check the restricted isometry property? And can this check that we can provide give us, in a certain sense, the maximal parameter possible? So let's try to understand how one should proceed. And I don't know what happened. Yes, but I hate this. Okay, so let's try to understand again what does it mean, the RIP property. The RIP property tells us that in the Euclidean norm, we would like that 1 minus delta x in L2 is less or equal than ax in L2 less or equal than 1 plus delta x in L2 for all x in some sigma k. That's a restricted isometry property. If you want, this is equivalent to say that as soon as we restrict A to certain columns, okay, where lambda has at most k entries, this is equivalent to say basically that this matrix times its transpose, it's nearly the identity. Okay? It's nearly the identity. Okay? Whatever set lambda you are choosing. So let's take A, which is our matrix. And let's take A transposed. This is A. This is A transposed. And considering a certain set lambda of rows and a corresponding set of columns and a corresponding set of rows of the transpose of A, it's equivalent basically to select some special entries of the product matrix. So we consider the product matrix here. This product matrix has n times n entries. And what are we doing here? We consider the lambda entries and the corresponding submatrix extracted by crossing lambda with lambda. So we are considering these entries. Okay? That's what are we doing. So, saying that whatever submatrix, small submatrix we extract, we want this submatrix to be nearly the identity, means that on the diagonal entries of this matrix, okay, we want those diagonal entries being nearly one. Okay? And the off-diagonal entries, so the entries which are off-diagonal, we want those to be very small. Okay? That's what you want. This is actually, that's not really what we are claiming here. We are claiming that from a spectral point of view, these two matrices are identical or very, very close. That means that, in other words, that the eigenvalues of this matrix are clustered around one. Okay? That's what you want to prove. So how can you prove that a certain matrix have eigenvalues clustered around something? Well, there is a deterministic method to do that by using the so-called Gershoring theorem. Okay? Gershoring theorem tells you that if you take an off-diagonal entry, I'm sorry? Gershoring. I think that is written like that, but you know, Russian names sometimes are written in 10,000 different ways. Gershoring theorem that tells you that the spectrum of a certain matrix, let's call this matrix say B lambda, the spectrum of the matrix B lambda is contained in the union of the balls of the center in the diagonal entries and having as a radius the sum of the off-diagonal entries in absolute value. And here we take everybody from 1 to the number of entries of lambda. Okay? So one way to do that is basically trying to prove that such type of matrices have a certain off-diagonal decay. So it means that you want that the maximal amount of information that is here is less or equal than a certain constant, and when you sum up k times that, okay, you still have that you are far from 1, so you expect this guy to be nearly 1, not too far, so that you can prove that this spectrum is equal, is nearly close to 1. Okay? But this technique, unfortunately, is bound to give you results of this type, that k should be of order of the square root of m. So if one follow this technique, instead of having k scaling like m over logarithm of n over m, you get that k has to scale more or less as square root of m, much smaller than that. Okay? There is a huge gap between the optimality, okay, and because this is much smaller than m over logarithm of n divided by m plus 1. Okay? So if you use a deterministic calculus, a method based on the simplest theorem that we have to estimate matrices, spectral matrices, but unfortunately is also the only one that we can really use in this context, unless you work with very specific matrix that has a very specific structure that you might play with. But so far, nobody found matrices for which one can improve this significantly. There are some little exponents here a bit better, but the work to achieve them was dramatic, okay? Was really, really difficult. And what is the issue here? That such estimates of the spectrum are based on taking absolute values, taking triangle inequalities, which are usually, or Cauchy-Schwarz inequalities, which are usually extremely rough estimates. Okay? So that's why the construction of optimal matrices, so matrices for which the RIP property scale with a K that is of this order, has been proved, the existence of these matrices, only by using probabilistic arguments. Why? Because in probability, usually you don't like to take absolute values. Okay? You can really compute integrals of your quantities and take an advantage of the estimated values and all this beautiful type of techniques in order to get your result. And you have, in this way, counted plus and minuses. You have counted faces in complex numbers, okay? While taking absolute values in your estimates are killing all this information. All the plus or minuses that are supposed to cancel each other, you lost them, okay? So that's why probability is a very, very useful tool in this case to prove that certain matrices exist with such optimal properties. Okay? So this is the motivation why we forget all of this and we go directly to the construction of matrices, to the proof that certain random matrices do have the RIP property scaling optimally. Okay, we will not prove such statement for any matrix or any random matrix. There are some distributions that allows us to do the game, and these distributions are constantly improving in a certain sense. In the following sense, that we are going to prove our statement for matrices whose distribution is such that a certain concentration inequality of this type hold. Okay? So this concentration inequality tell us that then whenever you test this function on a one specific vector, the probability that the result is off in terms of the L2 norm, so from the original L2 norm, is very, very small. Okay? One would like this particular concentration of measure property of these distributions. Which kind of distribution do have this property? Well, several distributions and the so-called sub-Gaussians, and in particular, I can mention three distributions that have this property. And we will prove this for only one. And general proof of these things will be part of a nice book that is appearing soon by Holger Raut and Simon Foucault. Okay, so very soon it will appear a book, a comprehensive book on compressed sensing, and this book in particular contains a very, very good, there is a good part of this book dedicated precisely to proofs of RIP properties for different type of random matrices, and somehow I would say that if somebody is very interested to such proofs one has to get into those details, and there is a lot to learn. Okay, so which kind of distributions do have this property? For instance, if you have your matrix A with a certain entries ij, you have that this particular inequality hold with a certain C0 function depending on epsilon as soon as aij is distributed like a Gaussian random variable with mean zero and square variance 1 over m. Okay? This is one instance, so these are called Gaussian matrices. But there are also other nice matrices like the Bernoulli matrix. So the Bernoulli matrix is basically the entries are minus 1 over square root of m with probability 1 over 2, 1 over square root of m with probability 1 over 2. Also, this particular distribution do fulfill that concentration property. And some variations on the theme, for instance, the one that is square root of 3 over m with probability 1 over 6, square root of minus square root of 3 over m with probability 1 over 6, and 0 with probability 2 over 3. So why the last one is particularly nice? Does anybody know why? There is a lot of zeros, okay? It's a very sparse matrix, okay? Which means that you can generate it. Most of the time you will write zero, which means that to store this matrix, you need not much space. Okay, except the fact that you have to remember where the zeros are. So that's a issue. In fact, so this is called Bernoulli. And this is another Bernoulli. And the point is that one of the most important efforts in done by certain groups of people working on compressed sensing. As I said, I think that Holger Rahut is the one who has been spending more time on this issue. He was trying to still use probability, but reducing the amount of probability in the generation of the matrix. For instance, they have been proving RIP properties for matrices which have only one row randomly generated and then rotated randomly. So constructing a partial circular matrix. Okay? So the randomization there is only at the level of one row and on the level of the rotation that you do to this vector. Okay? Other matrices are, of course, the partial Fourier matrix. So one is constructing the Fourier matrix and is selecting at random with uniform probability the rows, a certain number of rows. And estimated value of the number of rows is going to be m, and you select these rows at random. Also in this case, in a certain sense, the randomization affects only the choice of the rows that you have been selecting. The advantage of partial circular matrices or Fourier type of matrices is not only the fact that in order to store them or to generate them, the effort is relatively small, but it is also very important when you come to apply these matrices, because applying this matrix means making a matrix vector multiplication requiring that you really spend n times m an effort that is n times m. Okay? Are you with me? Because these matrices are going to be basically full. Maybe here one can try to have faster matrix vector multiplication, but in general, this is not the case. Okay? Are you with me? For Fourier matrices, we know that the Fourier transform, the entire Fourier transform, can be performed in n log n. Okay? And therefore, we have a reduction of the complexity in this case. And in particular, how do you proceed in applying this matrix to a vector? You compute the fast Fourier transform and you select at random some of the outcome entries, and you have your partial Fourier matrix vector multiplication done. Okay, that's how it works. So for these type of distributions, we do have such concentration of measure property. Unfortunately, for random circular matrices, a partial circular matrices, this is not the case in general, as well as for the Fourier matrix. And for those proofs, one need much more sophisticated techniques of probability that we are not going to see in this course. Okay, so we will try to investigate how can one find this particular concentration of measure property, and we will start with the case of Gaussian matrices, mentioning that these are the two cases can be derived from the Gaussian case. Okay, so that's how it works. Okay, this depends on the application. Of course, there are applications which are lucky, okay, and rather well tailored to this compressed sensing theory, where you can prove that the corresponding matrices do have RIP property. For instance, the partial Fourier matrix has been the basis for considering better MRI type of reconstruction methods. Okay, so, and there are some work by Donohoe and other people showing that this gives some better performances. I don't know exactly what they do concerning noise, but it's always a trouble there. But that's one case. There is a very recent paper by Holger Rahut, Thomas Stromer, and a student of Holger. I don't remember the name of the student. I'm sorry, I didn't get to know him. So where they are trying to approach the RIP property of radar sensing in radar sensing applications, and they are doing some steps in that direction. Seems that it will be extremely difficult to have a result of RIP, but they have found some result of incoherences of these matrices, which tell you indirectly that the RIP property holds not optimal, but at least with a good constants, relatively good constants. They will try to prove optimality, but it seems that is going to be very difficult. Other type of matrices are constructed by so-called time frequency shifts. So you take a random vector and you apply a translation and a modulation of this vector, okay? And by constructing matrices in this case, you are modeling basically problems in channel estimation in transmission, okay, in wireless transmission. And also in this case, they have been proving the RIP property of these type of matrices. So it seems that there is an interesting number of examples where the type of model that you have do fit quite nicely the framework of compressed sensing. However, there are many, many applications where we don't know what can be the interesting outcome, okay? But the concept of sparsity can still be a useful one, okay? I just mentioned one application. If this is it of interest for everybody to see my applications also? Yeah, okay, everybody is happy to see other applications. So there is one project on which I'm working currently, or I would like to work on, which is related to trying to give a name to certain stars, okay? So every stars, the thing that are in the sky. And the stars are pulsating. That means that every star somehow is changing its shape and as a balance between two fundamental forces. One is the sort of nuclear pressure due to the nuclear reactions of the star, and the other force is basically gravity. So as soon as somehow the star is very concentrated, then the nuclear reactions are accelerating and there is a nuclear pressure that makes the star dilating. But as soon as it's dilating, the forces are slowing down, this pressure slowing down, and the gravity plays a role, okay? So I'm not interested to be an expert of nuclear physics of stars, and we are looking for toy models from a mathematical point of view to try to understand what is the mechanism for stars to oscillate. The interesting fact is that the stars are oscillating in a periodic way. So they tend to repeat the type of shape change that they perform. So there are interesting results coming out very recently related to how certain drops are changing their shapes on the basis of repulsion forces and surface tension, okay? And these type of models are related to functionals, energy functionals of the of a certain distribution mu. And here you do have something like mu x 1 over x minus y to the alpha mu y dx dy plus some lambda, the total variation of this distribution mu. So you have, for those who have been seeing, the total variation is something like that. So where the distribution mu, it's very related also to the topic of this general semester. When this distribution mu is actually the characteristic function of a certain set, so what you have here is the perimeter of the set. Actually, let's put it RD. Here we have RD, and here we have RD. So this is going to be the perimeter of the set. And this non-local term is basically telling that the set was to want to expand. This is a repulsion term. So if you look at this as a particle, as particles, so if you assume that your mu is a distribution like 1 over n sum over j of delta xj, so it is not a general distribution but is an atomic distribution, and you plug it into this term, what you get there is the sum over ij of 1 over xi minus xj alpha. Minimizing this means maximizing the denominator. So you want that these particles get far apart from each other. Okay? That means that this term is a term that tends to make this set dilating. Okay? And at the same time, this term makes a constraint on the set in the sense that it doesn't want to become too large, otherwise the perimeter becomes large. Okay? Very good. So what you want is that the volume, in general, the volume is fixed of the set. This is another constraint that you put on this type of problem. The fact is that the minimizers of these functionals usually are, for lambda sufficiently small, are deformations of the sphere. Okay? So if you make lambda changing in time, you will make the change of this minimizer in time. And hopefully, if you make this particular parameter lambda oscillating periodically, you will get some periodic type of orbits of the change of the shape. Okay? So, which means that you will get perturbations of the sphere, and these perturbations are changing in time. And what we observe from these perturbations is the light, the change of the light of the star. So from far away, what you get is that, so if you are very far away, we are on the Earth, and we are looking at the star, what you get here is the change of luminosity of the star. I have no idea. Honestly, I have no idea. I'm working with astroseismologists, but what we are starting now is to see their data. So at the moment we don't know exactly. But the interesting thing is that what they observe is exactly a periodic change of luminosity. Okay? And this periodic change of luminosity has a specific frequencies. And these frequencies are characteristic of that star. It's a sort of fingerprint of the particular star that we are looking at. Okay? We have very specific frequencies. The good news is that although we don't check the luminosity of the star at every moment and every time, compressed sensing tells us that as soon as the spectrum of that function is sparse, okay, we can recover exactly the spectrum. And that's what they are doing, actually. So even before compressed sensing, they were looking, using certain algorithms in order to find out of noise, the fundamental frequencies of oscillation of the light spectrum, okay, of the light, of the luminosity of the star. What is not clear to me, and this is one thing that I would like to develop, is how from this information I can recover the precise shape change of the star. Okay? Whether it's really possible to find the particular function that is not only changing in, not only defined in space, but also defined in time, related to the deformation from sphere of the star. Okay? And this is again a compressed sensing problem, if you want. Why? Because we expect these changes to be periodical with a very specific type of frequencies. Okay? And this is a particular sensing we do of that particular function. So it will be very interesting to try to prove whether there is a sort of RFP property for this type of sensing, okay, in order to be able to recover how this function changes in time periodically, A in space, A in time, okay? This is another example. So the art of the compressed sensor is to find good applications where you can really get your RIP out of it. Okay? So that's the...
And then work hard.
Yes. Yeah. Okay? Please. Okay, so, yeah.
So mu is the shape, right? Mathematically, how do we get from mu to the to what they measure?
Okay, usually you assume that when the star is it's dilated in certain directions, it's less bright. And when it is more compressed, it's brighter because of certain nuclear reactions. And what you get is a sort of average luminosity along a certain part of the... So, it's a... Yeah, it's a sort of integral of the luminosity here. And so it's an average value of the luminosity. So you don't get such details, okay, but you get an average luminosity of the star. No, 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 no. I mean, so let's assume that this is the ideal situation. Yeah, so you have your mu. Okay. Let's assume that here is brighter and here is darker. And you have an observation plane, which is this one. Okay. You may sort of kind of project here the luminosity value, and here you make the integral of this function. Okay. Unfortunately, you might say that you don't see what happens here. Okay. So whatever is behind, you don't see it in a certain sense. Yeah. Yeah, it's a sort of the convolution, but sort of, but it's incomplete. I don't know whether by satellites they can see other. I don't think that the star is so far that to see it in another angle, you have to be very, very, very far away. So unlikely you can have much more of observations point, I believe. Okay. Any other question? Yeah, but you get RIP properties for situations or optimal reconstruction?
So we don't use the RIP, we use infrared.
Okay.
So, you know, if everything is fixed, then you have to deal with a fixed incoherence, but there are things you can do to sort of get around that. And that's also about that. So,
okay. Okay, understood. You use coherence. Okay, fine. So, yeah, that's the other issue. So, I make an example, which will return also later, which is the following. So, if you have a compact operator, which is the most common thing happening in inverse problems, many operators are compact. And what do you get is that your operator, somehow as soon as you have a spectral decomposition, do have some, say, decomposition of this type. Do you agree with me? Okay, with the lambda L's going to zero. Okay? So if you represent this operator in a sort of matrix format with respect to this particular basis, what you get is lambda 1, say, lambda L, and so on, and here you tend to zero. Okay? Are you with me? Okay, this matrix doesn't have the RIP property. Do you agree with me? Why? Because having RIP property means that you extract a submatrix, and the submatrix has to have eigenvalues which are close to 1. Are you with me? But as you know, this guy is big and this guy is very small. Okay? So, in general, this has not the RIP. Right? But if you precondition this operator by multiplying it or pre-multiplying by its diagonal to the minus 1, okay, you get here 1 everywhere. Do you agree with me? You will not be happy because the diagonal to the minus 1 is an unbounded operator. Right? So you are pre-multiplying everything with something which is basically bad. But if the solution of your problem is sparse, means that the space that you are considering is not infinite dimensional. It's a finite dimensional space. Therefore, the fact that this operator that you have been using to pre-multiply, to precondition the problem, is unbounded, you don't see it. Okay? So it's possible, even in infinite dimensional problems, as soon as you are looking for sparse solution, which intrinsically saying that the problem is finite dimensional, although you don't know which coordinates are actually active, okay, then it's possible to play and transform certain problems into virtually finite dimensional problems with RIP. And we will see that if maybe tomorrow. I don't know whether it's related to what you do, but this is another approach. Okay? Okay, now, let's forget, can we move this up? So let's forget for a moment situations where we cannot choose the operator or infinite dimensional problems and go back to this finite dimensional theory and random matrices. Okay, so I'll try to tell you something related to the how to prove in a relatively simple way this. Okay? So, or, are you interested to this? Is it an interesting, otherwise we move directly to infinite dimensional problems or algorithms and infinite dimensional problems. Random matrices, Yeah, okay. Let's consider it, okay? Fine. Okay, so I'll follow a very simple proof, which is due to Gupta and Dasgupta. And this it's a pretty nice proof because it's simple and it makes a lot easier to understand what is going on without having to get into a lot of probability. Okay? So it's a very, very simple approach that is quite interesting. So what we want to prove, first of all, is that provided a matrix IJ distributed like a Gaussian, then the following concentration property hold. For epsilon being less than 1, a bigger than 0, and a function C epsilon, a suitable function C epsilon, which is positive and basically we will try to see how these work. To do that, actually, we will try to prove two different concentration properties, which are basically, so this is implied by two concentration properties, and which can be shown one independently with respect to the other one, so that AX squared is basically less or equal than 1 minus epsilon X squared, and we want that this is less or equal than E to the minus M C1 epsilon, or actually C0 epsilon if you want, and somehow the combination of this together with the other inequality, so the AX squared is bigger than 1 minus plus epsilon X squared, and we want to prove that also this is E to the minus M C0 epsilon. As soon as you have these two particular inequalities, these are probability with respect to two independent events, and so if you want to detect what is the probability that both happen, you have to sum up the two probabilities. This is called union bound. Okay, so we would like to prove these two particular inequality. In order to do that, we would like to reverse the world. Okay, so now we are considering a random variable that depends on the fact that we have been choosing randomly the matrix. Okay, and we fixed for a fixed X in Rn. So you fix one X and you wonder what are those probability having your probability running over the matrix, okay? But actually, it is possible to show that this is equivalent to fix the matrix and making random X. So, in particular, it's possible to show that this is equivalent, these probabilities, so let's call it P1, the problem P1 is equivalent, basically, is equivalent to the probability that AX squared minus X squared, this is, is less than 1 minus epsilon S squared, is less or equal than E minus M C0 epsilon and blah 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 the rest for A being a very specific matrix, and so we call it A bar now. AE is taking a vector Z and is extracting from this vector the first, say, m coordinates, and we multiply everything by square root of n divided by m, and here exactly the same, n divided by m. We will see that this is the fact. So we take this specific matrix and x, x1, xn is generated at random with xi normally distributed, 0, 1. So we generate a vector, but we fix the matrix. Okay? So there, we were fixing the guy, and we were generating the matrix. Okay? And this is a property due to a certain rotation invariance of Gaussian matrices. Okay? So that's why you can rotate everything in one specific coordinate matrix and operate in randomizing the choice of x. Okay? That's more or less what you can do. So, therefore, it will be more convenient, actually, it's more convenient to prove this, that we call P2, than trying to prove P1. That's how somehow one proceeds. Moreover, as you see, the statement is homogeneous with respect to the norm of x. So we can divide everything by the norm of x squared. And so basically, we were looking for probability that, this is square root of n divided by m. We are looking for the probability that the square root of n divided by m times a y squared is less or equal than 1 minus epsilon or bigger than 1 plus epsilon, and both this statement less or equal than e to the mc0 epsilon, where y is given by x divided by x in norm. Okay? The interesting fact is that if x is a vector with Gaussian entries, then the normalization of it is a vector that is distributed uniformly on the sphere. And this is another property of Gaussian vectors. Okay? So if you take a random vector with entries Gaussian, generated as a Gaussians, and you normalize it, what you get is the uniform probability distribution on the sphere. Okay? That's the other particular aspect of the story. So we will try to address this issue and try to understand how this can be shown. Okay? So showing this will show this, and then you will show that. Okay? That's the three steps that you have to keep in mind. So why, in a certain sense, do we expect this to be true? The issue is that if you take your matrix A of Z, and you take, or actually A of Y squared, what is the estimated value of this quantity? y is a vector on the sphere, and therefore it has an L2 norm equal to 1. Okay? This matrix is selected, is selecting the first m coordinates of this vector, and this vector is generated at random on the sphere. So the fact that we chose the first coordinates, it's absolutely not playing any specific role. Every coordinate here has the same dignity and the same importance. So if all the coordinates, the sum over all the coordinates of the coordinates squared is equal to 1, summing up m of them necessarily is giving you n over m. I'm sorry, m little m over n. Okay? Again, for symmetry. Yeah. Okay? So, in other words, if you consider the estimated value or square root of n divided by m of a bar y squared, this estimated value is 1. Okay? That's what I'm saying. So what we see is that as soon as you generate a vector uniformly on the sphere and you select the first m coordinates, so you compute the L2 norm squared of it, what you get is m over n, or if you renormalize in a certain sense your matrix in a suitable way, you get 1 as estimated value. Okay? So what this inequality is saying to you is that the probability of being off from the mean value, it's small. Or whatever distribution you have here on this particular random variable, what you know is that the estimated value is around 1. You have your distribution, and whatever is on these tails of your probability, if you integrate it, you get something that is exponentially decaying to 0 with m. Okay? Okay, so here you have 1 plus epsilon, 1 minus epsilon. Are you with me? Okay, so now we have seen why we can expect such a estimate. Well, why we do expect something like that to come, because we have a deviation from a mean value, and we are basically making a so-called tail analysis of this probability distribution. Okay, maybe we cannot write explicitly who is the distribution, but we might be able to count the integral of the tails of this distribution. Okay? So we have the following lemma. So let m strictly less than n, 0 less than epsilon less than 1, and we have the first part of the lemma, which we call A. So the probability that the square root of n divided by m of a bar of x over the norm of x, everything squared, is less or equal than 1 minus epsilon. This is less or equal than 1 minus epsilon to the m over 2 times 1 plus epsilon times m divided by n minus m, everything to the n minus m divided by 2, and this is less or equal than the exponential times m divided by 2 multiply by epsilon plus logarithm of 1 minus epsilon, and this quantity actually is negative. Okay? So this is going to be minus C0 epsilon, let's say. Then there is the other side. So the probability that square root of n divided by m a bar x divided by x squared is bigger than 1 plus epsilon, this is less or equal than 1 plus epsilon to the m divided by 2, 1 minus epsilon m, n minus m, everything to the n minus m divided by 2. And again, this is less or equal than the exponential of m divided by 2 multiplied by minus epsilon plus logarithm of 1 plus epsilon. And again, this quantity is negative. Okay? So we prove this lemma. Actually, we prove, first of all, that part A, and then the part B follows very similarly. All right. So since this is stable, okay, I try to use this other blackboard. Okay, proof of A. So if psi is distributed as a Gaussian, then the estimated value of e to the s psi squared can be computed explicitly. Okay, how? You just take the integral over r, you get you get e to the s C squared, here you get 1 over square root of 2 pi, and here you have e to the minus psi squared divided by 2 d psi, and doing the computations this comes out 1 over square root of 1 minus 2 s. Okay? And that's more or less what you have from a direct computations of this type of integral. Okay? So, and this is true for s bigger than minus infinity and strictly less than 1 over 2. Okay, so we keep in mind this. How do we call this fact? Carrot. Okay, we remember it. And we want to prove that the probability that n times x1 plus xm squared is less or equal than m times beta x1 squared plus xn squared is less or equal than beta to the m divided by 2 times 1 plus m 1 minus beta divided by n minus m, everything n minus m divided by 2, where beta is actually 1 minus epsilon, or if you want that epsilon is equal to 1 minus beta. Okay, so this statement is exactly the one that we wrote upstairs, just with the beta and just having rearranged the P. So here we have this quantity, which I'm going to report the other side. So let's call it star. So we have star. What can we say about star? Star is equal to say that n x1 squared xm squared minus other way around. So we make it m beta x1 plus plus xn squared minus n x1 squared xm squared. This is bigger than zero. Okay? So that star is simply rewritten in that way. I just wrote the left-hand side on the right-hand side. And if you want, for every p positive, this probability can be written in the sense of an exponential. So we can write exponential of t, which multiply m beta x1 squared xn squared minus n x1 squared plus xm squared, and we want that this is going to be bigger than 1. So if a quantity is positive or non-negative, the exponential of that quantity has to be bigger than 1. Are you with me? And now this is going to be true for every t. So we fix any t positive, which multiply the quantity on the left-hand side, okay? And that's what we are going to do. Now, we have a function here defined on a certain probability space, and we are asking what is the probability that this function is bigger than some quantity. Now, I'm not the guy working with probability, so I just play with this only when I have to. So, however, I did a lot of measure theory. So, if you have a measure and is a positive measure on a measure space, and f is a map from x plus r plus measurable, you may wonder what is the measure of the set of x in x such that the function f of x is bigger than some gamma. Okay? So you have a non-negative function which is measurable, and you try to look at the measure of the set of this level set. Okay? The good news is that this can be nicely estimated, and this is given by 1 over gamma, the integral over x of fx, the mu x. So who knows what this inequality, how we call this inequality? Yeah, Markov if you are a probabilist, Chebyshev if you are an analyst. Okay? So that's exactly the Chebyshev inequality. And if you want, one can easily see that this is true as soon as f is a simple function. Simple function is a function that is piecewise constant on a partition. And so by taking appropriate limits, you prove it easily. Okay? Are you with me? So that means that if you, instead of taking a mu, you take a probability measure, so you take mu, you simply exchange these two guys, and you take f this function and gamma equal to 1, okay, what you get is exactly, this is less or equal than the integral, and the people in probability write integral with a big A, okay? You take the integral of your function, which is this exponential, I don't rewrite it, okay? And that's it, because gamma is 1. So 1 over 1, bravo, okay? Very good. But now we can invoke a carrot. You can invoke carrot because actually this exponential is quite nice in the sense that this integral basically is an integral over each of these Gaussian variables with each Gaussian as a corresponding weight with respect to the Lebesgue measure. Okay? So for each of these xi's, we are integrating xi against its corresponding Gaussian dxi. Okay? And the good news that here we have this exponential appearing a certain amount of times, so we use carrot, and what we get here is precisely this formulation. So this is, first of all, let's delete the carrot. This is equal to the exponential of t m beta x squared 2 n minus m times the estimated value of exp of t m beta minus n x squared and this to the m. Why this is the case? Because for n minus m coordinate, here, the multiplier factor is tmb, beta only, and for m of them, so the first m of them, the multiplier is tm beta minus n. But since we have m or n minus m copies of the same variable, we simply have the estimated values to the corresponding multiplicity, okay? Moreover, now we can use carrot, because these are Gaussian variables, okay? And we have been seeing that for Gaussian variables, we do have this particular quantity appearing. Therefore, what we get from these estimated values is 1 minus 2t m beta to the n minus m divided by 2 times 1 minus 2t m beta minus n to the minus m over 2. Okay? Simply we applied carrot to these estimated values, okay? Of course, this imposes some restriction now to the t. T was arbitrary up to this point, was any non-negative, any positive number. Here, we need some restriction, and the restriction comes from this, for instance. So what we need is that t m beta has to be strictly less than 1 half. And this is because of this particular restriction here. Are you with me? Very good. But the good news is that if this is true, then it's also that t m beta minus n is less than 1 half. Okay? So the only restriction that we have is actually this one, or that t belongs to the interval between 0 and 1 over 2m beta. And we keep in mind this restriction. Okay? So, what do we do in order to achieve the result? So we need to prove that this right-hand side has something to do with this number. Okay? So the way to do that is I consider this function, which I call gt, and I minimize it. Okay? I minimize it. To minimize it, what do I do? I consider f of t equal to 1 over gt squared, which is equal to 1 minus 2tm beta to the m 1 minus 2t m beta minus n to the n minus m, and I maximize. To maximize, I simply differentiate and I check whether I can find the corresponding point of maximum, okay, and by differentiation, I get that t0 equal to 1 minus beta divided by 2 beta multiplying n minus m beta is a maximum point. Okay? The very good news is that this maximum point actually belongs to the interval 0, 1 over 2 m beta. Okay? One can simply try to check that this is less or equal than this, and you find it immediately. So, if this is a maximum point for x, for f, it is a minimum point for g. Okay? And therefore, if you compute g at t0, you get exactly, say, this. Okay? And that's how you prove the statement. Okay? Okay. Now, as you see, somehow you are playing a lot. We have been using a huge amount of properties of Gaussian. So the certain rotation invariance, certain symmetries, the fact that somehow certain sums in exponentials become products of exponentials, and certain explicit computations that we can do with Gaussians, okay? So in general, anything that you try to prove with other distributions, like Bernoulli, you want to try to deduce it from the results that you have had already on Gaussians. And the motivation is that it's otherwise becoming very difficult to follow a similar path. Okay, so Gaussians is a very specific situation that allows you to make this computation quite easily. Okay, and this is a particularly beautiful and simple, clever proof of that concentration property. Okay, concerning the point B, okay, well, the point B is exactly the same, except for the fact that now you have to take beta equal to 1 plus epsilon, and here you find that this belongs to the interval exactly because beta is strictly less than 1. Okay? So if you follow the proof up to this point, you will find that for beta strictly strictly bigger than 1, actually you need to take minus t0, okay, to find the corresponding minimum of t, of g, sorry, where t0 is exactly the same guy, but with beta now bigger than 1. Okay? So the proof is identical, except for the fact that the minimum now appears on minus T0 and taking into account this particular difference. Okay? Are you with me? So algebraically is exactly the same except for this situation. Okay? Do you need 5 minutes pause?
Can I ask a specific question?
Yeah.
You were saying that one needs to account to get the RC, you need to somehow account for cancellation in a subtle way.
Yeah. Yeah, for instance, in the fact that if you want, first of all, it's the estimated value that we found, for instance. In this case, I think that it's hidden, first of all, in the spherical symmetry of the problem. Okay? We took advantage very much of the spherical symmetry that you see again when you compute the estimated value. Okay? We took advantage of that very much. So it's true that as soon as you consider the Gaussian variables here, everything is positive and doesn't seem to play any role the sign. Also, in these integrals, somehow you don't see signs appearing in a certain sense. But because we transform already the problem in this sort of beautiful canonical situation, taking strongly advantage of the spherical symmetry. So my feeling is that it is in that case, in that sense, that we have been taking advantage of some special sign things. So we normalize things in that way, taking advantage of a very specific situation of the Gaussian. But as an exercise, if you want, if you take Aij equal to plus or minus square root of 1 over square root of m, and now you take a multiplied by x, it's a very, very simple exercise. Just do that. It's very simple to show that this is true. Okay? And in this case, you don't, again, somehow, in this case, you see more clearly that here you really take advantage of the fact that you are averaging plus or minuses. Okay? So in this case, for the Bernoulli, this computation, you do that in 4 lines, if you want, and you can really see this particular property. In this case, in this construction that we made, we have been hiding everything into this spherical symmetry. Okay? That's my understanding and feeling about that. Okay. Let's make a 10 minutes pause now. Is it okay? So? Ah, okay. Yeah. Oh, that's very bad. Okay, so then we can assume that the probability that ax squared minus ax is bigger than epsilon x squared, this is less or equal than 2 to the e minus mc0 epsilon for epsilon in this range or for some function c0 non-negative. Okay, positive. So we assume this for our distributions. In particular, we have seen that Gaussian, it's okay. We call it carrot, and we keep it in mind. Okay, this is our basic assumption. It's a concentration of property that we want to have. So we start first with a lemma. So assume a random with distribution such that carrot holds. Then for any lambda subset of the index set, number of entries of lambda less or equal than some k, strictly less than n, and any delta bigger than 1, strictly bigger than 0, strictly less than 1, we have, is everybody seeing here or no? Then we have potato, which is 1 minus delta x less or equal than ax less